Chapter 57. Parent Killers. According to Freud, the crime of parricide, the murder of parents, is one of mankind's oldest established customs. He theorised that the earliest human beings lived in small hordes, consisting of one powerful male and several females. Naturally, the old male would want all the women to himself, and the only way the younger males could get their share was by rising up and murdering the old man. This, he said, is why man has always been haunted with legends of parricide. Well, he may have been right, but if so, he failed to explain why ancestor worship is among the oldest of mankind's religions. The ancient Egyptians, Chinese, Japanese, and Hindus worshipped their ancestors as gods, and many African tribes still do. Deep respect for the parents is the basis of Confucian religion, which is still the foundation of morality. Since the earliest times, parricide has been treated as the worst of crimes. Take, for example, the grim and bloody story of the Cenci family. Francesco Cenci was one of the most vicious reprobates of history. The son of the treasurer of Pope Pius V, he was the heir to an immense fortune that his father had accumulated by swindling. Francesco soon discovered that his money gave him immunity. If he wanted to sleep with a beautiful girl, he didn't have to go to the trouble of seducing her. It was easier to have her kidnapped and then to rape and sodomise her. When arrested, he simply bought his freedom. Altogether, he paid out over £500,000 in fines at various times. Cenci had 12 children by his first wife, and he hated them all. When the eldest two boys died, Cenci remarked that he wouldn't be happy until the others were buried near them. But as his youngest daughter, Beatrice, began to grow up, he found reasons for admiring her more than the others. With her pale skin and auburn hair, she was very beautiful. Cenci was so jealous of her that he transferred her and his second wife, Lucrezia, to a lonely castle near Naples called La Petrella. Francesco now decided to extend his repertoire of crimes to incest. When a young, rich nobleman named Guerra, an abbé, made several proposals for Beatrice's hand, her father finally told him the reason for his refusal. "She's my mistress!" Guerra thought he was lying and spent 3 days trying to see Beatrice. Finally, he got his interview, and she admitted that it was true. "He deserves to die," said Guerra. Beatrice, who was disgusted by her father's ill-treatment and avarice, agreed with him. Beatrice's stepmother joined in the plot, and so did her brothers, Giacomo and Bernardo. It was Giacomo who hired two sbirra, a kind of police officer, named Marzio and Olimpio. Marzio was infatuated with Beatrice, and Olimpio had already been her lover and the keeper of the castle at La Petrella until Cenci suspected and dismissed him. On the evening of September the 9th, 1598, the two women mixed opium with the old man's wine. Always a heavy drinker, Cenci passed out and was carried to his bed. Then the two murderers entered. They took a large nail and hammered it through his eye and into his brain, and then they drove another nail deep into his throat. The writhing body was then hurled out of a high window, where it caught in the branches of a tree. When it was found the next morning, it was assumed that Cenci had leaned too far off the balcony when he was drunk and had fallen. It looked like the perfect murder, except that Cenci's death was a little too convenient. A few months after the murder, the wheels of justice began to turn slowly. The court of Naples sent a commissioner to investigate the affair. The only evidence he could find against the plotters was the deposition of a washerwoman, who admitted washing a blood-stained sheet given to her by Beatrice, who claimed that the blood had been menstrual. No one really mourned the dead debauchee, but the crime of parricide was too horrible for the authorities to contemplate. If the Cencis were allowed to get away with it, the whole fabric of society might collapse. The Court of Naples decided on its favourite means of extorting confessions: torture. The abbé, Guerra, heard about these plans and hired two more sbirra to dispose of the murderers. They succeeded in assassinating Olimpio at Terni, but meanwhile Marzio was arrested. Under torture, he confessed. Beatrice, Giacomo and Bernardo were all arrested. When Marzio saw Beatrice, the woman he still loved, he promptly withdrew his confession. So the inquisitors thrust the Cencis into the torture chamber. Alexandre Dumas tells the story in his Celebrated Crimes, and he goes into gruesome detail. Beatrice was subjected to the strapedo. That is, she was undressed, her wrists were fastened behind her, and a rope was tied to them. and then she was hauled into the air on a pulley. The effect was to dislocate her shoulders. With incredible courage, she denied everything. Weights were attached to her feet, and every time she fainted, she was lowered to the ground. Then, as soon as she opened her eyes, she was hauled up again. Her brother, Bernardo, showed less fortitude. He confessed, and so did Giacomo, whose flesh had been torn from his body with red-hot pincers. Appeals were directed to Pope Clement VIII. He was sympathetic and about to grant a reprieve when news came of another case of parricide. The Marquis of Santa Croce had been stabbed to death by his son Paul. That settled it. Parricide was becoming an epidemic. The death sentences were confirmed. On September the 11th, 1599, almost a year to the day after the murder, the Cencis went to the scaffold. Beatrice was the first to be beheaded, and the executioner displayed her head to the crowd. Next came Lucrezia. Giacomo was killed by having his head smashed with a mace. Only Bernardo received a last-minute pardon from the Pope and a sentence of life imprisonment. He was freed after a year. Marzio had already died under torture. Guerra was the one conspirator who managed to escape. He fled from Italy and was never heard of again. This grim story has fascinated generations of historians, novelists, and playwrights. The poet Shelley made it the subject of his greatest play. Modern historians are inclined to reject the evidence that Cenci raped his daughter. But whether it's true or not, there can be no doubt that Francesco Cenci was guilty of far worse crimes than the one for which his children were executed. Compared to the passionate and excitable Italians, the inhabitants of Britain are relatively law-abiding. Yet, surprisingly enough, England has produced a number of classic parricides. The case that invites comparison with the Cenci murder is that of Mary Blandy, executed in 1752 for the murder of her father. Ever since then, writers on crime have argued about whether she was guilty or not. Mary was the daughter of Francis Blandy, an attorney of Henley-on-Thames. Her father was anxious that she should make a good marriage, and he let it be known that she would have a dowry of £10,000, a vast sum in those days. In fact, Blandy's total fortune was less than half that amount. The suitors came by the dozen, and were all rejected by Mr. Blandy. Time drifted by, and Mary was approaching 30. And then, one day, at an aristocratic house, she met the Honourable William Cranston. He was short and bandy-legged, but his manners appealed to the amiable and placid Mary. One day, Cranston confessed that he was in love with her, and added that he was entangled with a mistress who claimed to be his wife. Mary agreed to marry him as soon as this problem was sorted out. This time, her father agreed. Cranston may have been poor, but he was the son of a Scottish earl. He returned to Henley-on-Thames as a houseguest of the Blandys, and his intimacy with Mary ripened. But then came a setback. One of the captain's relatives wrote to tell Mr. Blandy that the mistress about whom Cranston had confessed was actually his wife. There were harsh words, but finally Cranston convinced the family that he was unmarried. For the next 6 months he lived with them, and Mary became his real mistress. Then the abandoned wife took him to a Scottish court, which found the marriage to be legal. And this time Mr. Blandy turned against his prospective son-in-law and told Mary to forget him. In truth, Mary adored her father and had always been an obedient daughter, but she was in love with Cranston. They continued to correspond, and one day it struck Cranston that the answer to his problems would be to remove Mr. Blandy. Accordingly, he hit upon a cunning plan. First, he gave Mary a powder, which, he said, would make her father altogether more amiable. Mary put it into her father's tea, and it seemed to work. For a few days he was much less bad-tempered. So when Cranston sent her more powder, Mary had no hesitation in putting it into her father's food and drink. She seems to have been a singularly gullible girl. When she discovered that her lover had another woman in London, she forgave him. When one of the servants drank some of her father's tea and immediately became ill, she still had no suspicion that Cranston's powder was to blame. She introduced the powder into oatmeal soup, and her father became ill as soon as he ate some. The cook tried the soup, and also became ill. The housemaid, Susan, had a small taste, and was sick for 2 days. Susan took the soup to the local chemist for analysis, and she warned Mr. Blandy that he was being poisoned. Francis Blandy undoubtedly loved his daughter. He hinted at his suspicion so plainly that she was panic-stricken and threw the rest of the powder onto the kitchen fire. As soon as she left the kitchen, the cook rescued it and took it to the chemist, who soon pronounced it to be arsenic. Mary drew the net more tightly around herself when she wrote her lover a letter warning him to be careful. She gave it to a clerk to post. He opened it and handed it to the chemist. On August the 14th, 1751, Francis Blandy died. He had told Mary that he thought she had poisoned him and that he forgave her. When Captain Cranston heard of Blandy's death, he fled to France. Mary was arrested and charged with murder. The trial was chiefly of interest because of the detailed scientific evidence of the poisoning. Mary's defence was that she believed the poison to be a love potion to make her father change his mind. In retrospect, this seems to be true. Why otherwise did she fail to get rid of the incriminating soup and the tea? The jury, though, disbelieved her, and she was hanged, asking the executioner not to hang her too high for the sake of decency. Cranston died in poverty just over 6 months later. There's an interesting sidelight on the case. When she was in prison, Mary Blandy heard about another woman who was condemned to death. Elizabeth Jeffreys had plotted with her lover to murder her uncle. The novelist Horace Walpole wrote in a letter that the motive behind the murder was that the uncle had debauched his niece. Mary and Elizabeth Jeffreys entered into a sympathetic correspondence, but before her execution, Elizabeth finally confessed to her part in the crime. Mary was shocked, and she wrote her a reproachful letter, which again seems to suggest that she was innocent. In the present century, one of the most horrifying representatives of parent killers was undoubtedly John Gilbert Graham, who was responsible for the deaths of 43 other people, as well as that of his mother. It happened when a DC-6B airliner exploded in mid-air shortly after taking off from Denver, Colorado, on November the 1st, 1955. The wreckage was spread over a five-mile area, and the smell of explosive convinced the investigators that the crash had been caused deliberately. The bomb, it was discovered, had gone off in number 4 baggage compartment, into which 4 cases had been loaded at Denver. The passengers who had boarded at Denver were checked, and one of them was Mrs. Daisy King, a lady of considerable wealth. Her son, John Graham, a 23-year-old married man with 2 children, had taken out insurance policies on her life before she left Denver, but had forgotten to sign them. Detectives soon discovered that Graham had a police record for forgery, and his wife mentioned that he had put a Christmas package in his mother's suitcase shortly before he left home. Under intense interrogation, John Graham finally admitted that he had made a time bomb with dynamite and had hidden it in his mother's case. He was identified by a man from whom he had bought the timing device. Graham was found guilty and executed at the Colorado State Penitentiary. He certainly ranks as the most spectacular and hard-hearted of all parricides. Our own time has seen the emergence of another type of parricide, who is both an immature and emotionally disturbed parricide. The central difference is this, that while the criminal parricide plots his crime with every intention of avoiding its consequences, the psychologically disturbed killer shows a complete lack of realistic foresight, fundamentally driven by a distorted, suicidal impulse. This can be seen in the case of Charles Whitman, the mass killer of Austin, Texas. On July the 31st, 1966, Whitman went up to his mother's apartment at midnight, stabbed her, and shot her in the back of the head. In a note, he wrote, "I love my mother with all my heart." And then he went home to his own apartment, stabbed his sleeping wife 3 times, and wrapped her naked body in a sheet. After this, he continued the note, describing his hatred of his father, whom his mother had left only a few months earlier, ending, "Life is not worth living." This done, he took 2 rifles, a shotgun, and 3 revolvers up to the observation tower of the University of Texas, and killed the receptionist with a blow from a rifle butt. A few minutes later, some people walked up the stairs. Whitman used the shotgun 3 times, slaying a 19-year-old youth and his aunt and seriously wounding the boy's mother. And then at 11:48 a.m. he began shooting from the top of the clock tower, shooting with terrifying accuracy. The first victim was a pregnant woman who collapsed with a bullet in her stomach. A classmate who bent over her was killed instantly. 6 more people were shot and many wounded within the next half hour. Police and Texas Rangers who surrounded the bell tower found that the angle at which they had to aim was impossible. The bullets only struck the walls. A light aircraft was chartered by the police, with a sharpshooter sitting in the passenger seat, but Whitman's deadly fire drove it away. Finally, at 1:24, the police managed to burst into the observation tower and to kill Whitman. An autopsy revealed that he would have died anyway. He had a brain tumour. 16 people died as a result of his orgy of destructiveness. But perhaps the most typical case of the suicidal parent killer is that of Miles Gifford, a 26-year-old native of Cornwall. Gifford hated his father, who was clerk of the court at St Austell Magistrates. The two of them were always quarrelling about Gifford's dislike of work. On November the 7th, 1952, Gifford asked his father if he could borrow the car to drive to London to see his girlfriend, and his father refused. That afternoon, while his parents were out, Gifford stayed at home and got drunk on whiskey. At 7:30, he heard the car returning. He went down to the garage and beat his father to death with a piece of iron pipe. He then went into the kitchen and smashed his mother to the ground. And when he was sure they were dead, he took the bodies, one by one, in a wheelbarrow and dumped them over the cliff at the end of the garden. He then got into the car and drove to London to see his girlfriend. The bodies were found the next day and the car was quickly traced, and within 24 hours of killing his parents, Gifford was under arrest. At the trial, his doctor described him as an idle little waster. And in spite of clear evidence that he was schizophrenic, he was sentenced to death and executed. A Cornish jury declined to accept the Freudian explanations of a psychiatrist who was called by the defence. In recent years, there's been a marked increase in the number of parricides, particularly in the United States. This is due largely to the increasing use of drugs. In one case, a man suffering from drug-induced delusions decapitated his mother and carefully placed her head on a church altar. And yet the increase is not great enough to support Freud's theory that the majority of people harbour some deep resentment of their parents. If this was correct, the release of these inhibitions by drugs should have led to a staggering increase in parricide. That this has not occurred suggests that Freud was wrong, and that the Chinese philosopher Confucius was right. Most people actually like their parents and wish them nothing but health, happiness, and long and contented lives.